and welcome to Volcano Bake Meat. I'm Paige.
I'm Connor.
I'm Grant.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm Jessica.
And today we're talking about limited thinking. Basically, there are a lot of games where the developers do not get the time, the budget, the ratings, the mechanical possibilities that they would like, but they still use that to put out really good games. But to start off with, we are going to talk about games that we love that had limited resources in one way or another. Connor?
So mine is definitely not limited anymore by any stretch. But for a game that I really liked that clearly suffered from resource limitations, I have Minecraft. Which I know I pull out every episode, and I'm sorry, it's my continuous fallback, but it...
Definitely not limited resources anymore.
No, definitely not anymore. Even before Microsoft purchased Mojang, the developer, they had grown substantially. Mm-hmm. Right, and they had no shortage of funding. They hired on a bunch more developers. But when Minecraft was first getting started, Mojang was a very, very small studio in Sweden, and they were just kind of making games like, well, let's see if this works. And I know Notch, the sort of lead developer behind Minecraft, did most of the coding himself, I think. Eventually, he handed it over, and it ended up being more of Jeb and Dinnerbone, who were, you know, maintaining it from there, but Notch really got it started, and most of it was just by himself. Which is why Minecraft is actually not that optimized of a game. It's actually very sloppy in terms of just... I mean, the whole game runs on Java, and it's very big for what it actually is. It's because it was the product of one guy making a game that he just kind of wanted to make, and there really wasn't any kind of serious demand for it. If you hear Notch talk about it, he just said he liked making games. So he just made a game that he thought would be fun, and it just happened to take off, and everyone got on board with it. But from the first time I ever played it, I was addicted instantly. Just because, I don't know why, stupid shit like building things and wandering and like building houses is my jam. I'm like, sweet, I can put blocks on top of other blocks and make things and then go in. It's like playing with Legos, like building houses with Legos, but then you get to go inside it and like play in it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's magical.
That is the key of the appeal. Yeah.
It's Lego for adults.
Yeah, but the key thing here is I thought Minecraft was fantastic before they ever got a ton of support, a ton of funding, a ton of more staff, and obviously ownership from Microsoft. So that is, I think, a great example of a game that was very limited but did very well for itself, and I love it to death.
My example is actually a game that not a lot of people realize was on strict limitations, but and is still like a huge cultural phenomenon and one of the more popular video games ever made. Super Smash Bros. Melee was incredibly limited. My understanding, I might be misquoting here, I know for a fact it was made very, very quickly. And so they had a very, very strict time crunch. I want to say it was made in like 12 months.
Wow.
What? Really?
It might not have been quite that short, but it was definitely, I'm pretty sure it was less than 2 years. Which is your usual dev cycle on a game.
Yeah, that's insane. Most people consider that to be the height of the series.
It is. Like, it empirically is. Masahiro Sakurai has said that he was putting in 12-hour days regularly, just making the game work.
Wow.
And if you really look into it, it's kind of clear where they cut the corners. There are a lot of clone characters in the game.
There are.
And that was because they wanted to do something else, and they couldn't make it work. They wanted Ganondorf to have his own full set of moves, but they didn't have time. So he's like, well, okay, make him slow Captain Falcon.
He really was a slow Captain Falcon.
He was Captain Falcon's animations, and of like the more advanced little techie stuff that you see in competitive Smash Bros. Wasn't supposed to be in the game, because it was never built to be a competitive game. Sakurai just wanted it to be a party game. And that's why Brawl and, to a lesser extent, Smash 4 haven't had the same success, because they had more time, they didn't have those little things in them, and so they're actually less competitively viable despite having more work put into them because of the different objectives of the game.
I don't really play that many games that I can think of where it's like, oh, this didn't have time, this didn't have money, just nothing really comes to mind with the exception of Brutal Legend.
Mm-hmm.
And I could spend hours talking about all of the things that went horribly wrong during the development of that game. Basically, you know what? You guys know the story.
It was quite the adventure, that's for sure.
Yeah, let's give a short version.
Version for the audience.
Okay, short version.
Keep it 3 sentences. Go.
Tim Schafer plugging along, making a game, gets the rug ripped out from under him, has to find a way to make it work.
He had to switch publishers.
Not only that, but didn't, like, one or two of his studio devs leave?
I don't know about that. Yeah, the only thing I know for sure is they had to switch publishers.
Yeah, they had to switch publishers.
Chunk of the game get cut.
Yeah.
There is no third act.
Yeah,
there is no third act.
Like, that was essential.
The act two final boss is back-to-back with the act three final boss.
Yeah.
There was obviously supposed to be, like, it was obviously supposed to be there and back again.
Yeah.
And you get there, and then you get teleported back again.
Yeah.
But
in spite of that, it was a good game.
In spite of that, it was a fantastic game. But that's because of the artistic vision and the amount of love that just went into the crafting of the world and everything about it.
I could probably come up with a few, but seeing as I also don't want to go through and buzz the same buttons I always do, I'm going to talk about Nidhogg. Well, Nidhogg was essentially just, like, this passion project that a guy did while he was in school, right? It was commissioned for a particular show, video game show thing, but he put it out, kind of like the concept, and then ultimately kept working on it until he created the final project, and here we are about to get a Nidhogg 2, which is really cool. Basically, if you haven't played Nidhogg, and I don't remember if I've talked about it,
I'm not sure if we have on the show. Anyway.
But in case I haven't, Nidhogg is this 2D side-scrolling sword fighting game. It's a fencing game. Basically, classic fighting situation of just you duel, you try to kill each other. But when you kill your opponent or just roll past your opponent, your only goal is to get to one end of the screen, like, and just keep going until you reach the goal. You know, but you also want to stop your opponent from getting to their goal. So it's kind of a fighting game mixed with tug of war, mixed with fencing, and it works out really well.
Mixed with stabbing.
And when you reach your goal, you are devoured by the mighty worm, the Nidhogg. Apparently, Wikipedia first took me to the article on what Nidhogg is in Norse mythology first, and then they're like, or did you mean the video game? And I'm like, I meant the video
game. Is Nidhogg the giant worm?
It is, yes. A giant worm. But yeah, no, basically this guy just made it as, like, a cool thing for this show and then ended up tweaking it continuously for 4 years while he, you know, went to school, worked on other projects. But it was just him, just making this one little thing, and then, like, it picked up enough speed.
It's a remarkably polished final product.
Oh, yeah, no, and I mean, like, I'm not sure if he had other people, like, work with him on it in the later parts, but it... The very least, it was just him for the first 4 years.
I think I'm going to go with a different kind of limit than the rest of us talked about. We usually think about limits in terms of, like, time or people or money. And I think we kind of did an episode on this earlier, but I'm going to refresh. One thing that can be a huge limit is your audience. If you're making a kid's game, you are going to be deeply limited in what you are and are not able to do. So I'm going to call out, there are a lot of games that could be called out that still have really interesting plots and stories, even though they're made for children. But I couldn't think of any of them, because I could only think of the Zelda series. The Zelda series is made for everyone. I played it since I was a kid, and my parents had no qualms, because it was child-appropriate. But even in one of the games that's more visually kid-friendly, like Wind Waker, there's still deep lore. There's still really interesting characters, and there's still some very emotional moments.
I was going to say, it does not... Wind Waker in particular does not shy away from the dark moments.
No, and it doesn't.
No, 100%.
But...
Like, Majora's Mask actually freaked me out a little bit as a kid.
Majora's Mask definitely goes a little further off the deep end.
Yeah. But it finds a way to work within the limits of what an... Is it E10 game can do? And presents a full story despite that, or even, you know, sometimes because you just have to focus in on the emotions and not necessarily shock. So we're going to go into the discussion of limits, and I think some of our examples showed, but I think we could go deeper into, are limits always a bad thing? In the case of Brutal Legend, definitely it was hurt by those.
Yeah, but there was so much more that could have been there, and we never got that because of the limitations. So that's one case where it's a bad thing, but there are other opportunities where it's a good thing. I'd actually like to bring up FTL, because FTL had the limitation of...
Lack of a third dimension.
Exactly. you know, it had a very simple concept, and it just took off on Kickstarter, and they were like, all right, how can we make this work with what we originally wanted to do without you know, trying to turn it into something else, and lo and behold, they delivered a fantastic product, but they had their own technical limitations of what they were technically capable of doing, what they had originally wanted to do, what people wanted from them, and these self-imposed limitations allowed them to really deliver an exceptional product.
Let's just set ground rules here, then, if this is something we can agree on. Limits are something you do not choose for yourself, necessarily.
I think that's fair.
That's fair.
If it's imposed on you from elsewhere, or if it's just, like, you do not have this thing, like, you know, if you don't have this programming skill, that is a limitation, even though that's not a choice, but you can't just go, and I suddenly have a better processor.
Well, same with staff, too. Yeah. If you're a one- or two-man shop, you don't choose to be two guys.
No.
You just are.
You just can't hire more.
You can't get more, no.
I think that, Jeff's point about FTL could be almost universally applied to any kind of indie game that didn't have a lot of resources and yet still managed to churn out a great product. Because I don't know how big the FTL team is, but I imagine it's not very big.
It's not big.
Yeah.
Probably not. I'd be surprised.
Yeah, and so, like, we could sit here and spend an entire show talking about little indie games with small, or possibly even one-man staffs that were able to...
Stardew Valley,
Undertale, Minecraft when it first started out, FTL, Binding of Isaac...
Nidhogg,
Rogue Legacy. Like, we could do that all day.
The list goes on.
But I think what we can say about that limitation specifically is when you don't have many people, your vision is very pure. Like, you have a lot of control over what goes into that game, even if the game cannot be as big. And in some cases, like... Nidhogg, probably like Stardew Valley, you don't have, you know, a boss who's saying we need to get it in at this time, so you can give it time to percolate and grow and evolve. But I think the strength of having a lack of personnel is having a purity of vision.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
And the indie advantage is that no one's going to hold you to a strict timeline.
I think the other indie advantage, which FTL is kind of a good example of, and Nidhogg is definitely a good example of, and the one I was thinking of is Oh Sir.
The
Insult Simulator.
It was made in a hackathon.
It was a game jam. Yeah.
Game jam, yeah.
Which is basically a hackathon.
Yeah. It's a weird game. It's a game where you're insulting each other in a Monty Python sketch with a lot of Monty Python themed or just nonsensical insults.
It's like it pretty much is the Dead Parrot sketch, a Telltale game.
And if every if every single song on the radio is a love song or a breakup song, and then every now and again you find that weird indie band that's singing a song about robbing a bank or that one issue of the G.I. Joe comic, that is Nidhogg, that is Oh Sir, where when you don't have a lot of time and you just kind of have to come up with something quickly, or you're just making something for yourself and you're not thinking about marketability, you are more likely to think of that idea that is very different than what other people have on the market. And just kind of scratch an itch that no one knew existed. That is a valuable thing. Although you do sometimes see it in bigger games, like what was Nintendo thinking with Pikmin? But that's another subject for another time.
I think the story behind this, Miyamoto was like, I have an idea. And they're like, whatever you want. It's kind of the exact opposite of he could kind of come with whatever he wants because he did something good. And he could be like, I have this idea. And they'd be like, I'm going to throw money at you. Do it. That makes sense.
Sometimes that backfires. I'm thinking of Tetsuya Nomura over at Square Enix.
What did he make?
The big thing he made is Kingdom Hearts. He was instrumental, but not necessarily the head on Final Fantasy VII, and that was his first big hit. And then he just kind of became Square's go-to guy for a long time, and after Sakaguchi left, then he really did become their number one. So he did pretty much any big headliner from Square in the last 10 years or so, but his baby is the Kingdom Hearts series. They'll give Nomura anything he wants. And that's part of why Final Fantasy XV took 10 years to make, was he had a huge vision for what this game was going to be, and it just got away from him. You know, he eventually left to work on Kingdom Hearts 3, but when Hajime Tabata inherited Final Fantasy XV, a lot had to get cut and changed, and what we ended up getting was a Final Fantasy XV that's still very, very good, but probably not what Nomura originally envisioned, and probably suffers for that. And then in the Kingdom Hearts side of things, they'll just, if he says, I have an idea for a Kingdom Hearts game, they let him make it. So Kingdom Hearts 3 still isn't out, but we've had 4 or 5 spin-off games. The legend, I don't know how true this is, but the legend is that he came up with the idea for Kingdom Hearts Coded, which is easily the dumbest of the spin-off games, because it was an idea that came to him when he was really, really drunk once, and he pitched it, and it got made. And that's how we got the game where Mickey Mouse turns Jiminy Cricket's journal into a computer and goes inside the computer and then has to fight data computer viruses inside of a book so that he can find memories from Sora in a magic computer book that will help him figure out what's going to happen in Kingdom Hearts 3. And this all leads up to Mickey deciding, hey, I should write Sora a letter. And that's the point of the game, is when Mickey decides he's going to write Sora a letter that we'd known he'd written since 2006.
And if you look as confused as Jeff looks right now, I wish you could see his face, like, eyes popping out of his head, mouth wide open. There's some drool dribbling into his beard.
His hand is positioned as if to say, hold the fuck up.
Yeah. If you are this confused, I highly recommend reading Grant's article on, like, catching up in the Kingdom Hearts series. However, there are some pretty significant spoilers in there as well, so be prepped for that. He does very clearly define that. It's on our WordPress site.
What?
It's okay, you can skip that one.
Okay.
You don't have to play that one.
Oh, thank God.
Just read Grant's article.
I'll finish that at some point. Just, holy shit. You're joking, right?
Is no.
That no,
that's the actual
that's,
plot
that's
of the game.
Exactly
oh my God.
That's the actual plot of the game.
How does this happen?
So all right. That's kind of a... See, I feel like we're kind of drifting away from the question of are limits always a bad thing to more are no limits a bad thing?
Oh, yeah,
oh, yeah, absolutely. No limits is definitely a bad thing.
Well, but, and, like, occasionally you'll get, you know, I think it's important to clarify no limits is different than...
Knowing your limits.
Or reasonable limits.
That too, but no, having no limits is different than someone taking a chance on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I feel like some games that ended up being incredibly popular, like let's throw out possibly like Metal Gear, or even like Brutal Legend or Kingdom Hearts, is because someone said, I have this idea. And they pitch it. And it sounds a little far-fetched, but someone has to go, I'm going to give you a shot. And there may be some inherent limits in there, but the whole point is they're basically giving them enough room to play with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you mention Metal Gear. The original Metal Gear was an example of limits. Like, the original 2D Metal Gear on the MSX computer, the whole, like, originally, it was just going to be a run-and-gun game.
Yeah.
It was going to be, you played a snake, you ran in, you gunned your way down to the bottom of the base, you fought Metal Gear, the end. But because of the physical limitations of the personal computer they were using, Kojima couldn't get, and his team couldn't get enough guards to render on screen for what he wanted. He couldn't make it technically work. I might be remembering wrong, but I think he found that his testers were purposely avoiding guards to avoid encounters, and he was like, well, there's a game.
It's not a bug, it's a feature.
It's a feature, yeah. So he just decided to rework it around, well, the point is to encounter as few guards as possible. You need to sneak around.
No, the other game where that is incredibly iconic for it is Silent Hill.
Yeah.
Silent Hill is known for its fog. It's creepy, it's spooky, you don't always know what's coming, and that's because they couldn't necessarily render what was coming.
Oh, it was a draw distance?
Yeah.
And so they just covered the entire game with fog, and now a ton of, like, emo junior hires love it.
Yeah.
See, those are both key examples of, from what I can tell, is really the only way to get around a limit was, like, if you're under limits, you either have to get creative or you cut corners somewhere and you have to take shortcuts or find some way to basically cover something up.
Sometimes that goes badly. Again, Superman 64. The draw distance was a problem. So they decided that Lex Luthor had covered the planet in kryptonite fog. Mm. So Superman could only see so far. That didn't work.
No,
so
it didn't.
I think the lesson from that is when you find a way to work within your limits, you also want to find a way to work within the game that you're creating.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means completely changing the game you're creating, like in Metal Gear. Or it just means throwing in the towel and crying like Superman 64 should have done.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel like you'll get developers or creators or even maybe even the publishers who, while working under limits, will try actively not to change the game, when in some cases that's what needs to happen for this to work.
Yeah.
Like, if you're like, no, we have to keep it this, we have to keep this element in the game, we can't remove it, and it's like, well, but we can't make it work, and it's like, no, we'll keep it in, and then it ends up breaking anyway. Mm-hmm. I honestly feel like, and I know this is kind of an anomaly of a game, regardless of what context you're talking about it in, but Duke Nukem Forever.
Yeah.
The latest one. When I played it, it just felt like there were so many features in that game that served no purpose and didn't really make the game any more interesting.
Like drawing a dick on the autograph?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of fun. I liked picking up my own poop. I was frustrated when I couldn't take it with me.
To the football field?
To the football field.
Yeah, to throw at the alien.
Yeah, but I think I ended up looking it up online later, and apparently... Sorry, Paige is laughing pretty hard right now. Did you not know you could pick up your own poop?
I knew you could, but just...
She wrote my article.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Right. No, but just the combined sentence... Okay, Jeff, you know how you felt a few minutes ago? Just the combined sentence of, you couldn't pick up your poop and carry it to the football field to throw out the alien probably makes more sense in context.
What you got was a game riddled with pointless interactions with the environment. And after a point, I kind of got a little pissed off, because I'm like, really? You could put all these pointless buttons for me to press and things for me to open and move around, but you couldn't make the combat better? Or you couldn't make it so that I don't have to wait 30 seconds to load the next part of the level? And I think that part of that was, they're like, well, no, but it's Duke Nukem. It's like, well, yeah, but it's not going to work with this game you have. It actively hinders the experience.
Yeah.
Actually, interesting example of, like, trying to cover up for your fuck-ups.
Mm-hmm.
There was a game that came out for the 360 that I'm pretty sure I'm the only person on the planet who's played, called Rise of the Argonauts.
I remember seeing that.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
I never played it.
Well, the thing is, it got a huge Game Informer cover, and I thought it sounded really, really cool. And it was one of those cases where it promised all this stuff, and then the game that was delivered didn't have half the shit that was promised.
Oh. Huh. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it talked about having, like, a realistic health system where instead of having a health bar, it would actually keep track of where you got hit, and that would just alter the way that you move. Like, if you got hit in the arm, your sword arm would get fucked up and everything like that.
Right.
And so it would be this more organic thing, and it just sounded really, really cool. And at the end of the day, the game that you got was, like, a weird poor man's Mass Effect, where, like, there were really only a handful of encounters in the entire game, and it wasn't very interesting. And the choices were ultimately just, which of the Greek gods will you offer this prayer to? You get this much XP with that god. Was pretty much what all the choices were.
Okay.
So it didn't end up being a very good game. But the one thing that made me think of it, you were talking about, like, the long load times between each section of the game. It had very long load times. And again, much like Mass Effect, Mass Effect covered that up with the elevators.
Yeah.
Which were also infuriating in their own way, but at least they could, like, throw in little tidbits of lore or character banter or things like that to kind of liven it up.
That's a very good point. I didn't think about that.
Oh, that's totally what it was.
Oh, yeah.
It's to cover up the load time.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
100%.
But, or at least make them easier.
Yes. Yeah. But in Rise of the Argonauts, it was less engaging. I recall in one particular part you were in some Greek place, and you need to get through the city gates to get to, you know, from one zone to the next. So instead of them just giving me a load time, it's just Jason walks up and he says, oh, I am Jason, you know, of wherever, and I wish to pass. He says, oh, allow me to raise the gate for you, my lord. And you watch this guy walk across the gate, shout down to the guy, raise the gates, Jason of the Argonauts is here. The gate slowly raises. Thank you. Good day, sir. Good day to you, Jason. And then you walk through. And it's the same scene every time.
Every time? God. The same scene?
Or at least it's a similar scene every time.
Jason.
So it's just watching a dude go through the procedure of... Oh, and the first time it's like, oh, well, that's a nice little bit of, you know, realism. And it adds some texture to the world. Wow, it's still going. Okay. Oh, I have to do this every time. I'll just hit skip and wait through the load screen.
Well, and I think one other limit that's really the big one, you can't really do much about it, or at least you couldn't, is money. Final Fantasy I was a go-for-broke money, and it worked, but sometimes you have a game that you're building, and it doesn't have the money it needs, and it has to either find it somewhere or stop. Game makers have found a different solution in Kickstarter.
Crowdsourcing
in general. And I think that comes with its own problems because it creates an illusion of lack of limits. And I think there are a lot of things that we could talk about when it comes to that. I mean, we could talk about people getting disappointed with Broken Age because it ended up being the game that Tim Schafer was trying to make instead of the game that they thought they were paying for.
That was the most classic, I think. That's the most classic case of...
That's both the first and most one of the most famous examples of... Mm-hmm. Crowdfunding games, because that was Tim Schafer basically started the trend of not only crowdsourcing video games, but crowdsourcing a lot of stuff in general, right?
Potato salad.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
They call it the Tim Schafer point, right? Like, basically Kickstarter only really got huge right around the time Tim Schafer started saying he was going to use Kickstarter as a cool way to do this stuff.
Good things and bad things have come out of the crowdfunding movement.
Yes. Yeah.
But I think the biggest one, and Grant can talk to this more fully, is Silicon Knights.
Oh, Silicon Knights. Well, that's not a crowdfunding.
No, it wasn't crowdfunding, but a sad tale of more money not solving problems, I guess.
Actually, Silicon Knights does have a good example for crowdsourcing.
They do have an example. I was pretty sure they did.
They do. I thought you were leading me somewhere else.
Okay.
Silicon Knights, yeah, they made Eternal Darkness, which is probably still my favorite game on the GameCube.
And still promised a second game that will never happen.
And still promised a second game that will never happen, and I've come to terms with that. Because everything Silicon Knights has done since... Well, no. Almost everything Silicon Knights has done since has been a total disaster. Everything they've done without the aid of Nintendo has been a total disaster. Too Human? I don't remember exactly how long Too Human was in development, but it was a long-ass time.
It was.
It was originally going to be on the GameCube, but ended up coming out, like...
It was on 360.
Mid to late 360.
Yeah, it was way later on. I remember because I saw the demo come up on the 360 feed, and this was after 360 had been out for a while. It was a mature console.
Yeah.
Same with the PS3. So, and this game's like, Too Human, finally out. I'm like, oh, okay, apparently this game's got some hype behind it or something. And I'll try the demo. I downloaded it. And I had played Mass Effect by that point, so parts of it weirdly reminded me of Mass Effect. The dialogue seemed very similar, so I'm like, are they trying to rip off Mass Effect here? What's going on? But it just... I don't know. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. I'm like,
the thing is, it got a lot of those ideas first, but it took so long to come out that by the time it came out, the ideas that it had weren't revolutionary anymore.
Like the Prince and the Cobbler.
Kind of like the Prince and the Cobbler, yeah. It's like the Prince and the Cobbler of video games, except at the end of the day, the Prince and the Cobbler was still a good movie.
So was it one of those cases where they took forever because they just kept being like, take your time, make it good?
I don't know exactly, but if I had to guess, that's probably what happened.
Also, because the head of the company.
And the head of the company is a total moron. Dennis Dyack, who is the head of Silicon Knights, there was a huge expose written on him a while back.
I remember that.
Yeah, where it, I can't remember specifically, but just his priorities were way out of order. And so it led to tons of wastage of money. After Too Human, they made an X-Men game called X-Men Destiny.
Oh, God, yes, they did.
Yeah, they did.
Oh,
that was really, really bad.
Forgot about that game.
And the story that... you also read the article page, so correct me if I'm wrong. But I'm pretty sure I think it was in that game they did a test. Like, you know, they were showing off the game to him as a check-in during development.
Like a tech demo.
Yeah, like a tech demo for him. And it was just a complete fucking disaster. And... The combat was broken, the animations didn't look good, it was not good. And his comment was, that truck in the back over there is gray. Who owns a gray truck? Make that truck a different color. He was concerned with the little minutia of the realism in the game, which is great when you're making something like The Witcher or Fallout or something grand in scope and the foundation you've laid is good. But you're making a top-down action game, and the foundation you've laid is horrible. And yes, he did try to do crowdfunding for a spiritual sequel to Eternal Darkness. I think he was asking like $3 million or $6 million.
Probably.
That's a lot.
For part one.
Oh, Jesus.
I think it was going to be like a six-part... Like he was going the episodic content route.
That's what other people did with after Tim Schafer hit it big with Broken Ages. They're like, oh, I can ask for $5 million for a game and get it. No, not really.
And he was going the episodic content route. So it was like, oh. And so a lot of people bought into it saying, oh, well, he'll make it and he'll just release it episodically. And they weren't looking closely at this is the budget for episode one. And so I saw that and I went, no. And so did a lot of other people. So it didn't get funded.
No, and I think that is a case where not understanding what limits are healthy kept us from getting a game that people wanted, but also he left the limits of Nintendo, which were helpful too.
Nintendo demanded quality. They said, we're not going to put this out, because they advertised the crap out of Eternal Darkness.
Yeah.
They put their name behind Eternal Darkness, that we're not going to put this out unless it's really good.
Yeah.
And so that was what pushed them. Same thing when they made Twin Snakes. They had first of all, they had the original game to base off of, and they had Konami and Nintendo both saying, this needs to be good. We've given you the engine. We've given you the game. Just put them together. They're putting together two halves of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
So
hard to screw that up.
In a way, they were given they were given boundaries. Mm-hmm. They're like, you have to stay within here. With Nintendo, it was more of like, you have to meet the quality requirements.
That would answer our first question. Are limits always a bad thing?
No!
In this case, Nintendo set those limits, and it made for very good things.
Yeah, in this case, it's... In a way, you could still call it a limitation, but it's like setting the bar.
Well,
like,
that's what a limit is. Yeah, yeah. The bar is a limit.
You can't go below the bar.
Or
above the bar.
I guess because... The way
depending
I tend,
on how you look at
when I hear limitations, I think of more of like you're being like restrained. When Nintendo says something like you have to meet this quality requirement, that's something that you would think they have to push for, mm-hmm. which is kind of the opposite of a limit. Like in my mind, at least, I mean, I'll clarify. I think you're absolutely right. That is a limitation because they can't just stop here. You have to keep going. Mm-hmm. It's not good enough. I just find it interesting. When I think limit, I think something that holds you back. But setting the quality bar of saying, no, you have to meet this, even if you have to push harder to get it, is technically a limitation, but really it's more, you technically have more room that you're supposed to use, but you don't, mm-hmm. because you're not used to doing that.
It's a different kind of limit.
Yes, and that's what makes, especially crowdfunding, and really just on a broader scale, providing money or time for developers so difficult, is because sometimes you'll just throw money at it, but you don't know if they're going to actually meet just the bare minimums that they need to meet.
Well, that's the common fallacy, right? Is the assumption that money and time is the only answer to any problem. And
right.
It's not, right? Like, money and time solve a lot of problems, don't get me wrong. But, like, a large part of what it comes down to with a lot of these games is, well, Paige said it earlier when we were talking indie games, clarity of vision, mm-hmm. right? You have to know what it is you're making. And you have to prioritize, like, what you're going to focus on. Are you going to focus on the fact that the truck is gray, or are you going to focus on the fact that your game doesn't work?
Well, yeah. It's also useful to focus on why the limits are there. This is going to get off, but I promise it's going to come back. Whenever you get people who are starting to do writing, they think that every story that is ever written has been boring because it follows the hero's journey. And they need to write a story that does not follow that hero's journey. They are limited by the traditional arc. And so they write crap. I mean, 99 times out of 100, like, they write crap unless they have, you know, some genius clarity of vision and they understand the hero's journey so distinctly that they understand why it doesn't need to be there. Yeah. A lot of times we see people failing within their limits is because they don't understand why those limits are there.
Right, yeah. They don't get the reason why they can't do this or they have to meet this.
Yeah.
They feel like, they look at the wheel and they go, who needs wheels?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, don't reinvent it. It's fine. It's circular. It moves the cart. We're good. Yep. Just build me a better looking cart. Yeah. That's all I was asking for.
And that's a continuous problem that Peter Molyneux from Lionhead Studios, the former Lionhead Studios had. If you're not
may
familiar.
It rest in peace.
May it rest in peace. You know, Molyneux himself was kind of a weird guy, but
wait.
I...
What did they make?
I was going to go into that.
They made Fable!
Yeah. Molyneux himself was kind of a weird guy, but him and his studio made the Fable series, which, despite its issues, it is one of my favorite series. It's a lot of fun. It's got a lot of charm, and it has some really cool mechanics to it that makes it a very fun game to play. Molyneux's problem, though, was that every Fable game felt like two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
So to speak. Because Fable 1... had its ups and downs. There were things you could do and things you couldn't, things that players wanted to do, realized they didn't have the freedom to do that, and there were some things that didn't work quite well.
But it was so glorious.
But it was glorious. But I think if Lionhead Studios, and particularly, I'm curious to see how true this is, but I get the impression Peter Molyneux was one of those like really hands-on, controlling creative types. He always wanted to keep trying new things. When he didn't realize, like, no, the more complexity you add to this, the more things you keep changing... the more we're going to have to account for, or the more little bugs are just problems and confusing things it's going to create. And the one, his thing was, he didn't realize he had limits, but he did. It was like, no, you can only do so much before you start, this is the Duke Nukem problem, before you start hindering the game. I'd be curious, I mean, Microsoft Studios were mostly the ones who published the Fable games, if I'm not mistaken.
100%.
And I'd be curious to know how much they really... limited Lionhead Studios for the Fable games. Because you would think if they have a formula that works, just do the formula again, tweak it slightly.
From what I've been given to understand about Microsoft Studios, in general, they tend to actually let the creative teams do what they have to do. They just get kind of weird about how some of that goes moving forward.
But
in terms of, like, the management of the actual game itself, that was probably mostly left up to Lionhead Studios.
In the case of the Fable games, I don't know. I'm curious if it would have been better if Microsoft had, as a publisher, placed more limits on Lionhead and Molyneux and said, no, keep these things in. Don't do all these new things you want to add. Because you're messing with the formula that works.
Yeah, now that being said, it seems like Fable Legends was a case where Microsoft may have stepped in a little too much. I'm not sure, because it's not totally clear. All we know is that Fable Legends was what they were working on when Lionhead folded. But Fable Legends originally was going to use this combination of tablet and Xbox One. You know, Surface and Xbox. Dungeon Master, it was a D&D sort of setup where Dungeon Master had the Surface, everyone else was playing on console or PC. Well, not hardly anyone who actually does gaming in any sort of serious way owns a Surface or is going to be using that Surface for gaming, right?
Yeah, and it's a very specific.
So they tweaked that formula a lot. But when it was first pitched, I think, or it, like, publicly, when we first got that public taste of Fable Legends, that was what the idea was. And they scrapped it pretty quickly. But my guess would be Microsoft probably made that particular suggestion. Be like, we need more people to be trying out the Surface and this new smart glass app of ours or whatever. But
that's true. There may have been a little bit of oversight there.
But as far as I can tell, that's as much as they ever stepped in beyond, look, we have to close down Fable Legends.
Yep. So, and actually, this is making me think of another point. So, we mentioned before that time and money seem to be the most common, if not the most impactful, limitations that game makers have to deal with. Money, we've kind of talked about. Crowdfunding is one of the ways you can get around that. I don't have enough funding. Let's crowdsource it. Take it straight to the end customer. They'll invest in it. But the other question that I'm interested in maybe talking about is, how do game makers get around the limit of time? Like, I only have so much time to actually make this game. Actually, they do. They do. There is one way. Early access programs.
Kind of.
If you go can only take you so far, and they're only applicable in certain situations,
It's not an overall game ender. It's not a final solution to the whole "we don't have enough time" problem. But if you only have, but if you're crunched for time for making a game, you can release an early access alpha, beta, say that it's an alpha and beta, and start. I would argue
that that's more for producing revenue than it is for producing time.
Well, it could be, but think about
it. But if time is money, that revenue can then buy you more time.
Without a doubt, but I'm just saying, like,
that's one of the failures of that is a lot of game makers will take advantage of that and just use it to get a lot of money without doing a lot of work. Right? Like, actually, I think Rust is in trouble for that. They've started focusing a lot more on DLC and adding stupid things, but not really fixing the game.
Is Rust still technically early access?
Yes. Yep,
it's still technically an alpha, I think.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's even in beta yet. Not officially. So they're kind of in hot water, but for a lot of developers, early access is a way to keep the game alive until they can finish it. Until they can get across the line. I'm struggling to think of any specific examples that did that. And actually, you know what? I think Starbound. I could be wrong, but I think Starbound is officially 1.0. I think they're out of early
they
access.
They are.
Yeah. But they consistently were releasing good updates, and the game itself is good.
I mean, also Minecraft.
Also,
yeah. Minecraft, technically.
Actually, that's right. They only went 1.0 year. Like, for years, it was technically a beta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They only went 1.0. I can't remember what year.
It was already a thing.
Well, we're only
and it
on,
technically wasn't out yet.
We're only on, like, 1.14 or something.
Like 1.11, 1.12.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
it's
early.
Yeah, but the advantage of early access programs is let's let some people in now, and let's take a discounted price for our game, but let's get some revenue in just to keep it going until we can get across the line.
Keep the doors open.
Yeah, keep the doors open. Keep fuel in the tank.
Mm-hmm.
More analogies about stuff like that. But it's
and get some player feedback
precisely
to help clarify your vision.
And that's another way you can
reduce costs of Q&A.
Yeah,
well, costs and time too. In that sense, it also kind of solves the resourcing problem. Not entirely, but just for feedback and testing, you can get players to actually give an opinion.
I mean, I feel like early access is training wheels on a bike. If you use it correctly, it can help get you where you need to go quicker than if somebody had just given you a bike and given you a push, and you'd fallen over a lot. But if you keep the training wheels on for a very long time, like Rust is doing, and you use that as an excuse to have a slightly easier time of it, then you won't ever go as far or as fast as you would on a bike.
Exactly. You might get that little boost in the beginning, but eventually everyone else is going to outpace you, you're going to fall behind and just stagnate. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens a lot with early access, which is unfortunate. But that, I think, is what I've seen is an effective way to get around the whole time issue. Aside from that, I think you kind of had it right, Grant. They don't.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about annual releases.
So, like, every year, like Call of Duty, Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, Assassin's Creed, although I think they're backing off on Assassin's Creed now.
Assassin's Creed has officially... Ubisoft has officially said they're not going to be releasing them year to year.
But for a long time, they were.
They were. No, 100%. That was a guaranteed $60 out of my pocket.
I was going to say, you're the expert. Did the quality suffer?
Oh, 100%.
I would imagine it would have to.
100%. So, they did catch up a little bit where, basically, they had their A team and their B team.
And that's how they usually end up doing it.
Yeah, they alternated, and once they figured out the pacing, it was okay, right? They all sort of did mediocre work, except for Rogue, which was clearly done. So Rogue came out same time as Unity. The idea was, here's one for the 360, here's one for the Xbox One, or PS3, PS4, however you want to parse it.
Previous generation, next generation.
Yeah. But Rogue is literally just a crappy carbon copy of Black Flag, and I say crappy carbon copy because there are literally technical glitches throughout. There's really nothing interesting going on in it. One cinematic, I'm talking to, like, somebody, and he just blips out of existence. I'm like, are you serious?
You offended his sensibilities so hard he ceased to exist.
I haven't done any of the side quests in Rogue because I got so freaking fed up with it. I'm like, I'm just gonna... And I played the whole game in, like, 4 hours and just, like, finish the main game, said fuck it. Well, yeah.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Well, yes, it suffered. I'm mad.
I think the difference is there are some other games that we didn't talk about that have annual releases. Madden, FIFA, like, sports games put out pretty regularly,
now,
and because...
Sports games...
Well, because sports don't change. I mean...
And the formula for that is genius, which is we're going to change these very little aspects each year so that, like, really the major thing that changes is your roster.
Yep, your players change.
You hold the roster hostage.
And you change the features a little bit over time.
But you pick the one, maybe two aspects you want to change, right? So, you know what? In FIFA, we're going to focus in on... these kicking mechanics. We want to make sure that the way they dribble the ball is as realistic as we can possibly make it. And that's the one change of whatever year they do that for.
And I think the difference is, like, the difference between making a new season of a sitcom, where you're going to have the same characters, the same kind of jokes, and so you can keep predictably getting the same laughs, and making a new Fast and the Furious movie. And maybe Fast and Furious isn't the best example. Maybe a new
Bond movie. No, it absolutely is a great example, because when you're looking at an action franchise like Fast and the Furious, what do people want? They want something that's going to capture the same excitement and thrill and adrenaline as the, you know, the vault scene in Fast Five, right?
Which, to be fair...
Was pretty great.
Even though that is impossible, they're trying to top the vault scene in Fast Five. Look at the Call of Duty.
When it comes to those films, they have to be the same but different, the same way Assassin's Creed has to be. And when they don't achieve that, then why am I bothering to see that?
I really think Call of Duty is a prime parallel. Because what has Call of Duty been chasing since Modern Warfare? They've been chasing the nuke scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every single Call of Duty has needed their nuke scene.
Yep.
And...
we'll link to it, but in Call of Duty 4, there's a scene that involves a nuclear bomb going off. And it was... impactful.
It was incredibly impactful because it was this huge, I mean, even leading up to the bomb, it was a really well done huge action set piece.
Very tense
scene where you're running around, you gotta, like, get your helicopter pilot out of a chopper crash, and you're gunning down people and wherever you are.
It was essentially Black Hawk Down.
Basically, it was very Black Hawk Down, although louder. It was the loud parts of Black Hawk Down. Then you get hit by a nuke, and, like, you play as the soldier getting hit by the nuke, and it's this huge show-stopping moment. Modern Warfare 2 was constantly trying
to chase that. It tried to do that 3 times in a single game, and it didn't work.
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of dropped off the franchise after that, but from the little bits I've poked in, it seems like they're constantly trying to up the ante, up the ante, up the ante,
yeah.
Like a freaking Michael Bay movie.
Exactly.
And
lo and behold, it's suffering the same fate.
Yeah.
So, to get back to the topic, what we're saying is that they have not learned how to use their limits effectively.
They're an example of no limits being a bad thing.
Well, I don't know. I think it is kind of not using your limits effectively, because it really sucks to have to release a game every year.
That is the same game.
Well,
the same genre.
It both has to be the same game, but it can't be the same game.
That's really restrictive.
It's incredibly restrictive because the developers have to change enough to make it interesting, but you can't.
And worth buying.
And worth buying, but you can't change the good parts that people want to be the same. Eventually, I mean, no matter how creative or innovative of a designer or developer or architect and writer you are, eventually you're going to run out of ideas, and you're going to have to start
cutting corners. There's a reason they ended up canceling Friends.
Yeah, you're going to have to start cutting corners or trying to just go for shock value, because you can only find your way out of a box so many ways, right? Before you just have to, make another box so that you can think your way out of that. That's a confused analogy.
Or eat the box.
So, I mean, unless anybody has anything more to say, I think what we've got here is that, once again, Volcano Bake Meat says Modern Warfare 32 bad, Stardew Valley good.
Yeah. This is our new title.
So that is limits, or at least a limited discussion of limits. And that brings us to our molasses round. So, guys, what we want to do is each one of us is going to come up with a game idea. The next person is going to come up with a limit, and then everyone has to figure out how to make it good anyway. So it's a little like the adaptation one.
So we're talking about an existing game, but put a limit on it.
I think for the sake of making this easier, it can be.
Okay.
It can be, but all's open.
Yeah, all's open.
No, do you have a new idea for a game?
No limitation on what the choice of
if you want a simulator of someone eating a Nutri-Grain bar...
I think that has limited itself.
Yeah.
Like, I'm already having ideas.
Shout it out.
Well, I kind of want to do Paige's Nutri-Grain bar idea all of a sudden.
It's a good point. I kind of have an idea for that.
Yeah. How would you limit it?
Nutri-Grain bar simulator, eating simulator.
2017.
Yeah. you have no talented artists on your staff.
So it's just like a stick figure.
So
you have to find a way to make it look compelling. You have no artists.
Oh, you have no art skill. I've got one here. XKCD presents eating a Nutri-Grain bar.
I was gonna say, yeah, go for like the charmingly low,
simple, dumb.
Yeah,
down.
Charmingly simple style, so, where it would just be like an XKCD stick figure with little witty text comments and just like MS Paint bars.
I think the thing that we have to keep us going here, it's not plot, it's not mechanics. It has to be dialogue. You have to really love that man eating that Nutri-Grain bar.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. It's going to be
character development.
You make up for the bad art with it. It's like a weird, deeply deep story for a poorly drawn game.
Mm-hmm. See, my limit would be that it has to be first person, and you have no idea where your mouth is, but you are judged on how well you fit it in your mouth.
And like Surgeon Simulator.
The thing I would do is then make it for the Vive.
But you also have to make it for the Vive.
Make it for the Vive.
Yeah.
Or the Oculus or whatever. VR. VR it.
Ooh, kind of do it like a, keep talking so nobody explodes, so there's actually another person who has to fit the Nutri-Grain into your mouth.
Oh, God.
Yes. All right, let's take it to Kickstarter.
Yep. Funding is no longer a limitation.
Yeah. Okay, I got one. Let's say, for the sake of argument, like a big BioWare-style RPG that, or maybe a Telltale-type game that's very much about strong character work and relationships between them, and then that's the real driving force to keep the player motivated to play. You can only afford one voice actor.
John St. John.
John St. John?
Yeah.
Who's he?
Duke Nukem.
Oh,
no.
God.
No. He's good.
My limitation is now you can only afford John St. John.
So wait.
I'm going to go for a different voice actor. John DiMaggio.
You could get a very versatile voice actor.
Point is,
Billy West.
Okay, so
actually, you are a team of, like, because we never specified what the game was, and
no.
I'm assuming we're early in development. You are a team of kick butt female, like, world savers, all voiced by Tara Strong.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds like the simple answer to this problem is let's get a voice actor with a ton of range.
Yeah.
Which would be Tara Strong.
Or if you're in the video game universe, Nolan North.
Yep.
I think John St. John is the right idea.
Yeah.
I really do.
I would basically just plot hack it. I would make the story about just multiple timelines.
Okay.
Where you have to go and stop yourself from doing stupid shit.
And
wrecking the world. So you only ever have to deal with yourself.
Okay.
But each version of yourself is slightly different.
Or Inside Out the game.
There you go.
You could get away with that, yeah, in an Inside Out game.
Yeah.
Another thought I had was make it a Star Wars game and you play as a bunch of clone troopers. then you only need Dee Bradley Baker because, again, it's kind of both.
We're actually taking
all of your clone troopers are Dee Bradley Baker. Also, Dee Bradley Baker does great monster sounds. So it's just you're fighting, like, Rancors and Lykex and shit the entire game.
That's true. Or, you know, go with the standard RPG route. Same typical RPG story, mechanics, plot structure. But let's do that thing where we have an innovative approach to the game. Where typically RPGs are just riddled with dialogue and interaction between other characters. Make the RPG where you have to travel through, but every interaction that the main character has with just villagers and NPCs are just only his own reactions to them. So the whole RPG is like you're stuck inside this guy's psyche and how he perceives the world and his relationships with people. So it's like a weird...
Being Commander Shepard.
Kind of, yeah, but like you can't... like that can be one of his hindrances is that he can't relate or connect. Like he has some weird curse or something on him. So it's just all internal monologue, and you have to basically guide his decisions based on how he reacts rather than what other people say.
That could be
weird but good.
Alternatively, we could go for accessibility. Your protagonist is deaf.
Yeah. No, that...
So hand gestures, then.
Yeah, it would be all sign language.
Oh, you have to learn sign language.
Reading lips. I mean, like, subtitles, obviously, but it could be, like... You know,
or when your protagonist reads lips, he hears it in his own voice.
Yeah, and so, like, what... I mean, we've talked about...
I would play all these games.
Yeah, I've talked about
Overwatch. See, I was just gonna say, I'd go for the, like, Civilization or Zelda approach of just make the one voice actor make weird grunts.
But, I mean, like, the thing is...
Sims.
It could be a very different perspective if we had a deaf protagonist.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And we've talked about how Overwatch is on, like, audio cues. We as a society use a lot of audio cues. What if we didn't have those?
Yeah, you would really have to change the way people play the game. Make it much
more. I'm fascinated now.
I know, this way.
Somebody else say something before I fall too far down this rabbit hole.
All right, guys, I have an idea for a game. It's one that somebody thought up here a while ago. I want to see an open world space exploration game based on the Firefly universe.
Designed for the N64.
Oh, damn it.
Okay, so Firefly for the N64.
Open world Firefly.
Open world Firefly for the N64. Well,
can we be kind enough to just bump it up to the...
We can make this work because, I mean, our definition of open world, strictly speaking, Banjo-Kazooie was open world. You could run around and wander off to all the different worlds all you want.
It's true.
So, actually, basically Jet Force Gemini.
Jet Force Gemini was the shit.
Jet Force Gemini with a little bit of Perfect Dark thrown in.
Just reskin it as Firefly.
Yeah. So, you, admittedly... Well,
how did it get over the limitations for those of us who have never heard of this?
It was basically just a third-person shooter. You'd essentially just have a large world that was a third-person shooter, and pull a KOTOR, and traveling from planet to planet was just turret segments.
And it was also fairly fast-paced, too.
Yeah.
You're almost always moving, running, shooting, jumping, so you didn't really spend a lot of time looking at the textures. So you didn't have to focus on so much of, wow, this looks like shit.
Yeah, so you could, I mean, the thing is, Firefly is a versatile enough universe, you could be in the, you know, in the gunning seat of the Firefly, or the Serenity, rather, or you could be, like, on one of their hover cars, cruising around, shooting out the window, trying to gun down, you know, get away from Reavers. Or you could be on foot in just a third-person shootout. Any of those could work. There was actually an N64 game called Operation Winback that had a rudimentary a precursor to Gears of War's cover system.
Really?
Yeah.
On the N64?
On the N64, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so you could easily make that work. It wouldn't look great, but it's an N64 game.
No.
But then you would lose all of Mal's facial expressions.
But that's okay.
No, but it would be perfect because you'd have just the blocky Mal head with the really bad N64 texture model over it of just the one cocky grin all the time.
Like GoldenEye?
Yeah. Like in GoldenEye, yeah. That'd be beautiful. Oh, I'd play the shit out of this.
And then when he's trying to look sad, the cocky grin just sort of downward.
Or just changes to him frowning.
Yep. I would love to see him, like, fall to his knees, like, suffering, and then looks up and he's got the grin, like,
these are great. Give me another one.
Okay, so one idea I have, and maybe this is a little freeform, let's see what we can come up with, is I want to see a racing game kind of in the vein of, like, Cruisin' or Outrun, where it's the somewhat 3D, mostly 2D, like, just straight car racer where you have to finish a level, except you don't have a top-notch sound designer. So how are you going to account for the fact that you can't make cool driving tunes or car noises that are actually accurate? I mean, you could try and make them yourself, I guess, but you don't have a sound designer or a Foley artist on hand.
There are two modes of the game. There's easy and hard. And for one, you license the Beach Boys.
Oh, no.
And for one, you license the Beastie Boys.
Which is easy and which is hard?
That is the real question.
I got one.
At this point, the music is so loud, you don't even hear the car noises. It's just Sabotage blasting in your ears at full volume.
Yeah. I'd be into that. No, I got one. So you make it the art style all looks like hand drawn with like crayons, like it's drawn by a child.
And then
then all the sound effects are just a kid going.
So it's like you're playing in like a little kid's imaginary race game.
Yeah, or like making them very obviously.
I actually had a similar idea. So
or very obviously look like Hot Wheels on like a plastic track or something. So it's a kid playing with Hot Wheels.
Oh no! Get the team who did like Kirby's Epic Yarn and Yoshi's Woolly World, so it's this cute little, like,
beep, beep, broom,
like, adorable little world, and
yeah, but yeah, so somehow spin it so it's a kid playing with cars.
That would work.
Yeah.
I'd play it. Racing games tend to take themselves, like,
way too seriously.
Way too seriously, so I'd still get into that. See, actually,
I was gonna take it in a totally separate direction. I was gonna say just get really bad car noises and then just really muffle them and have the piano part to Mad World and just have a timer going that continually goes up and stops when you finally crash the car.
Oh, God.
And this has been Volcano Bake Meat. Thanks for joining us, and check out our social media and tell us about what games you thought were limited well, limited badly, or unlimited when they shouldn't have been. We love hearing from you. Thanks for listening, and for Volcano Bake Meat, I'm Paige.
I'm Connor.
I'm Grant.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm Jessica.
And we're Volcano Bake Meat. Thanks for listening. Join the conversation online by visiting our website, volcanobakemeat.wordpress.com, emailing us at sosimplyverygood@gmail.com, following us on Twitter at sosimplyverygood, good spelled G-U-D like a lolcat, subscribing to our subreddit, rvolcanobakemeat, following us on Facebook at Volcano Bake Meat Radio, or checking out our YouTube channel, Volcano Bake Meat. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast or review us on iTunes and Stitcher. Our opening theme is by Tekne, spelled T-E-X-V-N, and you can find his work on SoundCloud. Our About Page portraits were drawn by Sarah Tillery. Her art can be found at stillsart.tumblr.com, and she is open for commissions. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.